We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it? I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 106. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, and it's going to be on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog section. I want to remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right, A Meme-Enhanced Primer on Encroaching Marxism in the West. It is available on Amazon. It's available for paperback, and it's available for Kindle. With Kindle, you can have it in a couple seconds. Today, I'm here with Scott Horton. I think we all know Scott by now, foreign policy expert, wrote the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, editor at antiwar.com, director at libertarianinstitute.org. Scott's going to talk about the recent history of Somalia. He's going to talk about Gary Webb. Then we're going to talk a little about Netanyahu's PowerPoint presentation from earlier in the week. So what's happening today, Scott? How you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good, good. I heard you on the HAPA supremacy live stream the other day talking about Somalia towards the end of it. Mm-hmm. And you had, being a libertarian and being an anarchist specifically, I've been told to move to Somalia, I mean, 150,000 times. So I think it would, I don't know if most anarchists, people who call themselves anarchists or libertarians, know much about Somalia. I've studied some of the when the state just fell apart, went to shit. But since then, people have a lot of ideas about what's going on there and what has happened there. And you seem to have a lot of knowledge on that. So I wanted to ask you, after, I think it was around 1979 when the government started falling apart there, what do you know about it?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, the communist government fell apart. I guess Saeed Barre, if I'm probably saying it wrong, his regime ended, I think, in 1991. And then they were basically warlords, civil war fighting through most of the 1990s. And Americans remember the Black Hawk Down episode was a mission that George Bush Sr. had started, Operation Restore Hope, to provide food aid at the end of his term in 1992, or toward the end of it. And it was operation that, Bill Clinton took up then, which turned out to be a disaster, and a bunch of Rangers and Delta guys got killed there in a firefight. There may have been some others, I'm not sure. But Bill Clinton was like, what the hell are we doing in Somalia? It was early 93 or mid 93, I guess, his first year in office. And he was just, I don't want anything to do with this, and pulled the troops out of there. Later, by the way, Bin Laden told Abdel Bari Atwan that he was really disappointed. He wanted to bog America down in a war of attrition right there in Somalia at the Somalis' expense. Thank you very much. Way back in 1993. But anyway, he ended up getting his way later on in Afghanistan, et cetera. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So, I don't know exactly what was American policy, post Black Hawk Down in the 90s, other than it was more or less hands off. You had nothing like that level of intervention. But then when Bush took power, and then after September 11th, the Americans, stepped up intervention big time there. And the story, I guess, was, and this was still the cover story or the official story in the Washington Post as late as 2006, is that there were three, count them, one, two, three Bin Laden associates, Al-Qaeda guys, in Somalia somewhere, not being hosted by the government there or anything, but just somewhere on the run as fugitives, guys who the U.S. blamed for being responsible for the African embassy attacks or being involved in the African embassy attacks. And as late as 2006, that was the pretext for the full-scale intervention, was, well, we're hunting three guys. So more or less the story was that, well, somebody who, you know, knows bin Laden's former roommate is in Somalia somewhere or something. And so in 2001, JSOC and the CIA, I'm not sure who was there first and whatever, but they've both been there since 2001 after September 11th. And people famously, people remember the famous Wesley Clark statement. This is the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO under Bill Clinton, the guy who almost got us all killed in 1999, by the way, in the Kosovo War. But anyway, Wesley Clark in, I guess, 2007, way too late for a lot of this, came forward and told the story about how the neocons had written up this plan and how he had, was a guest at the Pentagon. He was retired then, but was still welcome at the Pentagon as a retired four-star general, of course. And that one of his, I guess, former subordinates said, "Hey, General, come in here and look at this," and showed him a memo that said that the Americans planned to overthrow seven governments in 5 years. And that was, you know, obviously Afghanistan, Iraq, or I don't know, Afghanistan was already taken for granted. I forget. Wait till I count. I'm done counting on my fingers here. Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, Somalia, and Sudan. So, yeah, I guess it was Afghanistan was on there, too. Or Libya. No, Libya was the – so Afghanistan wasn't on the list. Libya was on there. So, anyway, Somalia was on the list already. And they didn't even really have a government at all at that time in 2001. And where this whole narrative – I mean, this, honestly, the narrative about libertarianism in Somalia is nothing but a parenthesis here. You know, it has nothing to do with anything, really, other than – at the end of their civil war in the late 90s and early, you know, 2000s, right at the turn of the century, no one had really won. More or less all of the different warlords had exhausted themselves. And so there were still highwaymen here and there and checkpoints here and there and what have you. There was no real taxing authority, no real regulatory authority over anything. The port of Mogadishu was wide open and – you know, the most cited example and therefore the easiest to remember is that they had the fastest growing cellular service industry in all of sub-Saharan Africa at the time. And it was really doing great for their economy. And nobody had read Rothbard, but it was more or less a de facto anarcho-capitalist system. And the power had devolved basically to whoever was left. And that was basically a bunch of old men, the uncles and the grandfathers, and in some cases, the imams. It is a Muslim country, but they're, you know, really Sufis, I think, mostly. Or I'm not certain about that, but they're some kind of Sunnis, but they do not have some kind of radical Saudi type view of Islam. And they never did. But so during this, you know, transition time between the Civil War and American intervention at the dawn of the Terror War, they actually had a de facto free society for a couple of years, 2-3 years. And there were studies done that said, hey, look, it's really working. Freedom is working for the Somalis. And so then that ended up being used against us that, yeah, oh, everything is great in Somalia after everything was turned to complete chaos, where nobody on either side of the argument really had any idea. You know, and most of this was completely covert until 2006. I mean, you could read about it in the Washington Post from time to time, but most people had really no idea about this intervention going on at all. And so, I forgot where I was going with that, Mance. But the point is that, I'll find a different point to make. Yeah. So the American people hadn't heard of the we can edit that, right?
No worries, man. God.
So people hadn't heard of the intervention there. All they had heard was a bunch of pompous bow-tie libertarians, I guess, saying, see, freedom's great in Somalia. Meanwhile, people are starving. But people didn't know that there had been this intervention in the meantime that had made all the difference. And I think this was partly some of the libertarians' fault because they didn't know about the intervention any more than their left-wing accusers who were using this attack against them know about the intervention there. So they were still saying that freedom works in Somalia in some instances, or they, you know, are trying to defend against the accusations that things had gone to hell there, because they didn't know that the answer to why, of course, was because of George W. Bush. Ruined everything, just like he ruined everything for everyone. And so, yeah, I mean, seriously, why isn't that the default answer for anything that happened at the turn of the century, for real? And, of course, it's the true answer. It's the correct answer. So here's how it happened. America comes in 2001, and they start backing the warlords, in fact, including the son of Adid, the bad guy from Black Hawk Down. And they started backing him and these other warlords, and they said, hunt down Islamists and kill them for us. Well, so these guys took the CIA's money and guns and then did whatever they want with them and made more enemies for themselves. And the more people resisted their tyranny, the more the CIA would give them money and guns in order to continue to take the fight to these Al-Qaeda terrorist guys, who obviously are the only ones who would resist these people, even though they're the bad guys from our last intervention there just a few years before. But anyway... And so there's this, you know, perfectly simple and obvious cycle from 2001 through 2004 and into 2005, where the more the Americans backed the warlords, the more enemies that they made, and the more people rose up against them to force them out. And in fact, I think in a couple cases had forced them across the border into Ethiopia. And then in 2005, this happened one last time, where the CIA backed this major force of these guys, and 13 different groups came together to form the Islamic Courts Union. And, you know, like capital U in union there. And coincidentally, 13, right? Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So unite or die. So war is the health of the state. In this case, war created a state. You know, people needed a monopoly security force to resist the CIA's, you know, death squads, basically. They're dirty warriors. And so, and that has a real definition, that word dirty war. You know, the CIA, you know, Phoenix programs type, cutting people's throats in their sleep and this kind of thing. Anyway, blackmailing people and torturing people and killing women and children. And anyway, so the 13 groups came together and created the Islamic Courts Union, and they forced the warlords across the border into Ethiopia, defeated them, and drove them out. And at this point, the Bush administration decided that they weren't going to let that stand, and they sponsored in Christmas 2006. It was, I guess, by the end of 2005, the Islamic Courts Union had won, and then, or mostly won, and were consolidating their power through 2006. And then there was a lot of hype because they closed a couple of movie theaters or something. So they were trying to portray it like this is the rise of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or something like that, when, you know, they weren't really that right-wing in the first place, and they didn't have the ability to enforce an authoritarian society in the second place, even if they did just want to be the Taliban. And besides, America loves the Saudi way in Saudi and everywhere else where it's convenient for America. So don't pretend like, you know, don't let the Washington Post fool you that that was a problem for the Americans, that they were so sad that the people of Mogadishu couldn't go to the movies anymore and we had to go save them so they could and wear short skirts and watch movies and this kind of garbage. But anyway, so Christmas 2006, Ethiopia, which is a Christian nation and a historical enemy of the Somalis, invades with U.S. support. Special Operations Forces and CIA helped with the entire invasion, including C-130s flying and firing on people below. There is a torture and rendition program and all of this. And, of course, the Islamic Courts Union was smashed. Their government was dissolved. And the people fled, the people in, you know, who ran it fled. And the smallest and previously least consequential group of the 13 in the Islamic Courts Union, the youth, Al-Shabaab, they went to war. And so whereas before it was the uncles and the imams and the old men who were making the decisions, now you have an actual fight on your hands, and or again and worse, and so the youth take up arms, and eventually they become this group that, you know, later ends up pledging their loyalty to Al-Qaeda and their goals, which is, you know, convenient for the empire as well, of course, but it's a good way to get money from the Saudis and stuff like that, and so it's important for them to do that. And so now, ever since 2006, why haven't you heard? There's this terrible group, Al-Shabaab. And so now we have to intervene and go over there and protect the people from this terrible group of terrorists that were all the Americans' fault 100% in the first place, who were created in the first place in reaction to American intervention there. And then step by step by step, you know, we made them into the most powerful group that had to be reckoned with. So since 2006, America supported the Ethiopians and then also African Union forces, the Burundians, the Ugandans, and the Kenyans as well. And they come and go from time to time. But the war has been really bad, and especially in 2010 and 11, there was a terrible famine. And a huge part of the famine, of course, was that even though there was a drought in the entire Horn of Africa, in Somalia, they were at war. And so in Kenya and in Ethiopia and in other places, they were able to, you know, figure out ways around the crisis. At least, you know, people went hungry, but they didn't starve to death. Well, in Somalia, they starved to death. And it's, you know, USAID, FuseNet, which is sponsored by the USAID and by the UK, they reported back in, I guess, 2013 that 250,000 people had died in this famine because all of the systems of distribution in their economy had been broken. It wasn't anarchy and freedom that had killed them. It was the American Empire had turned their country upside down, the most powerful government in world history. Had turned their country, maybe the weakest, most helpless collection of people, the people of Somalia, in relative terms anyway, to the Americans who picked this fight with them. And then so when people say that, you might picture the number 250,000 in your head or whatever, but instead picture little babies and toddlers laying down dying, because that's who dies. It's children under five, you know, mostly, and elderly and other sick people. And it's because of the war caused this massive deprivation, the breakdown of their systems of food distribution. So the farmers can't, reap or sow their crops. And even if they can, they can't get it to market. And even if they could, the market's closed and there's no customers and there's no money and everybody's, you know, living in a refugee camp on the side of the highway somewhere. And so, in that chaos, of course, it's the weakest people who suffer the greatest. And so, I'm trying to figure what I left out other than, so the CIA has been there all along. Jeremy Scahill found a CIA torture prison there, and believe it or not, Eli Lake found another one, and I would never believe something Eli Lake said, except that it was, hey, Obama's got a secret torture prison up here in North Somalia. Who knew about that? And I thought, he seems credible in this instance. Anyway, you can forget Eli Lake if you don't like that, but read Jeremy Scahill in The Nation. He had two important ones back in, I guess, 2012, about American policy in Somalia, where he draws this out step by step, and it's in his book Dirty Wars too, where he draws out step by step by step how this is all America's fault, and he nails it. Oh, and by the way, I knew there was a parenthesis back there I'd skipped and wanted to get back to, Mance, is on page 222. Of Jeremy Scahill's book, Dirty Wars, he has a quote from a Bush administration official. Because in 2008, the Bush administration was out of time, right? It was over. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't really succeeded in accomplishing any of their goals there. And they ended up compromising. And Condoleezza Rice invited Sheikh Sharif, who had been the chief under the Islamic Courts Union, and she said, okay, you can be the president, but it has to be in the form of not the Islamic Courts Union, but this transitional federal government that the USA and the United Nations have created for you. And you can be the president of that, and we'll allow that. And, of course, Al-Shabaab considered them traitors for going along with that and continued their war. In explaining this, Jeremy Scahill has a quote of this Bush administration official saying, well, we just wanted to take Sheikh Sharif down a peg. And so it was okay if we keep him. And he ended up staying the president through 2012. And it's been other American, you know, installed lackeys since then. And so they started this whole war. They fought this war where hundreds of thousands of people have been killed. In the words of the Bush administration, to keep the same leader. They weren't even intent necessarily on a full regime change against him. They just wanted to insist on changing the form of his government from one thing into another, take him down a peg.
Jesus.
And that's American foreign policy in Somalia. And of course, you know, Al-Shabaab is a thing right now. And Obama used drones against them and special operations forces. And Trump has sent in the infantry. There are army infantry on the ground in Somalia now, not just special operations forces training the African Union and not just drones in the air, but American GIs on the ground. So, which of course means the thing is only going to get worse.
Why? Why this fucking country? Why a poor...
Check your map.
I mean...
It's the Horn of Africa, man. It's geopolitics. The politics of geography and who rules the gates of the Red Sea there, the Bab al-Mandeb and all of that territory.
Jesus, man. Yeah, I can't help
but think. Oh, no, you know what it is? What? They're hunting three Al-Qaeda guys. Wanted. I like this, the Washington Post. Well, they're wanted for questioning by the FBI for their role. There's not even an arrest warrant out for them. They're wanted for questioning by the FBI for their alleged role in the Africa embassy attacks. Because you see, terrorism is a crime, punishable under the law in the courts. And so it's not really supposed to be the military's problem anyway. It's supposed to be the FBI's problem in the first place. And so, but this is their excuse. This is what they call a manhunt. Well, there's three guys wanted for questioning. So we're going to call in the Ethiopians and who committed mass war crimes, by the way, on their own, rapes and murders and all kinds of torture and horrible war crimes against their historical enemies, the Somalis, during this. And we're going to go to all these lengths because we're looking for three guys. We want to see if maybe they're guilty. See if maybe we can get one to flip on the other or something.
Jeez, man. I was listening to, I don't know if you've had a chance to listen to CJ's latest Dangerous History podcast, but he's talking about, it's called Remember the Maine, and he's talking about Theodore Roosevelt and all those, you know, looks like you could see the birth of foreign interventionism and just the attitudes he talks, and he's like actually quoting, you know, them about how we just need a war. You know, we need to prove we haven't been at war, you know, now for 30 years. So we need to, we need the world to see that we're still strong, and we need to prove, you know, and a lot of them are Anglophiles. So they wanted to be like England. And it's just, I mean, it's, and yeah, that went right through Wilson, and that started all this shit.
Yep. Well, I'll tell you, man, you know, Will Gregg had this great article back, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, about when they stole Hawaii, maybe 15 years ago. I don't know. And he has this great quote. It's like the best quote ever. It's like the most eloquent Ron Paulian sentiment about how, you know, you can't be a republic and an empire. And, you know, let me tell you what's exceptional about America. It's all the ways that we're not like England, and whatever exactly how he said it, I don't know, but it was beautiful about how, you know, the virtue is in resisting the lure of unlimited power. You know, you're only supposed to do what you're supposed to do, not what you can get away with, whatever, in the best way. And it was a senator, you know, who given this most eloquent speech on the floor of the Senate, and then his opposition rises and says, well, in contrast to the gentleman from Ohio or wherever he was, he says, you're a wimp, you're a fag, you're whatever, you're a sissy, and everybody who, like, is a strong, tough guy knows that it's time for America to become a full-grown man, or, like, just some garbage, some, like, not even fit for John Bolton, just tripe, you know? If you can do push-ups, then you know that we gotta go to the Philippines, or, you know what I mean? Like, unless you're into knitting, then we're going to war.
And I guess people went for that. That was the sentiment that won the day, right? It was like, what is all this stuff about be wise and prudent and live up to George Washington's highest hopes for our society or whatever? Nah, screw that, you know? I'm not saying George Washington's hopes are mine, but I'm saying that was their frame of reference, and they were, you know, they were abandoning, quite deliberately, abandoning the legacy of a limited republic in favor of let's see what all we can steal from these savages, which I guess is the same story from the beginning, isn't it?
And I think what's interesting is that if you go, you can go as far back as you can go, you can see the press being the cheerleaders for this, the mainstream press, just like, yeah, this is and it's today.
It's good
and you can see it. Yeah. I mean, shit, war is great for business. Speaking of the press, you had shared an article earlier this week, probably over the weekend, that I guess it was from The Intercept about Gary Webb. And I wanted to ask you, because I know you told me that you had actually interviewed him. Gary Webb uncovered some uncovered probably one of the something that conspiracy theorists before that had talked about, but he basically broke the lid off of
drugs being brought. Senator Kerry had investigated this in the 1980s. Quite a few years before Gary Webb had taken it up, and I'm sure, I don't know exactly when Alexander Coburn started publishing, but I know he was on it before Webb. But what happened with Webb was, and I say that to say, because those aren't conspiracy theorists, but they are alternative media people, you know. Coburn is, Counterpunch and those guys. And John Kerry's investigation, I think he even did submit some kind of report at some point. I don't think I ever read it. But it didn't really go anywhere. It certainly did not catch anybody's imagination. But when Gary Webb's story came out, Dark Alliance, in the San Jose Mercury News, it caused this huge firestorm. And a big part of what it was, they didn't just dismiss it and just kind of ignore it. They decided to go full jihad against Gary Webb and against the San Jose Mercury News and do everything they could to attack him and destroy him when everybody would have just shrugged and ignored it anyway, really. And I think a big part of that was, I mean, maybe just the CIA was terrified of what people might think, that it could, threaten their power in some way, which is, pretty far-fetched if you ask me. But also, the other reporters hated him because who the hell does this guy think he is at the San Jose Mercury, whatever. And so the rest of them all just basically became deputies of the CIA. And especially at the Los Angeles Times and at the Washington Post, they went absolutely full-scale destruction against Gary Webb and doing everything they could to undermine his story and to undermine and smear and attack him and to put words in his mouth that he never said. Like one of the things that he never said was that the CIA did this in order to destroy the black community because they hate black people so much. Well, he never said that. He said, they don't give a damn about black people, obviously, and if this is what happens to black people, that they have to suffer this massive crack epidemic because of this huge influx of supply of cheap cocaine directly into the hands of criminals in, the Bloods and the Crips, gangs and others in southern Los Angeles, then whatever, dude, they got a war to pay for. They don't care because they're the CIA. They don't care. And if he's, I don't even know if he made that judgment at all. He just said this was the consequence. And then they went and said, oh, yeah, Gary Webb, the kook, who says that the CIA went to all this trouble just to make black people smoke cocaine. Yeah, right, which he never said and, of course, sounds really stupid, but that's how they do it. And now they even admit, oh, gee, yeah, I guess we were kind of unfair to him. Yeah, they completely destroyed him. And I remember thinking even, I remember seeing one column inch. It was one of those tiny little side things in the Austin American Statesman that reporter at the San Jose Mercury News who wrote that cocaine story has been moved to the tabloid section of the paper. He's going to be writing about, the new TV shows coming out now or something like that. And, he had previously been in I think previously, too, he had been an investigator for California congressional committees. and stuff like that. So he was a serious ass investigator and journalist, and they just destroyed him. They ruined him, and his editors wouldn't stand up for him. In fact, I think one of the things that he got rightly criticized for, it wasn't his fault, it was the editor had changed something to make something seem a little bit more inflammatory and put it in the paper, and so they had to walk back one thing, but that was enough, right? It was like, oh, they admit that they made up a thing, and then so, you know, it just... That was good enough to use to smear him and attack him. But anyway, so the story is, if you're interested, the story is that there was a Boland Amendment in Congress that said that was a congressman, they passed this amendment that forbid Ronald Reagan from spending money on backing the Contras in Nicaragua. And the CIA under William Casey said, well, we're just going to do it anyway and we'll get the money from somewhere else. So part of that was, of course, linked to the Iran-Contra deal where they're selling missiles through Israel to Iran. Yeah, that's right. Israel got along with Iran, just with the Ayatollah Khomeini, just fine, and selling missiles for us to them. And then supposedly to get hostages out, although I don't think they actually got any hostages because of these specific deals. But they did get some money from the Iranians, and then they funneled that money to back the Contras in Nicaragua. And then one of the other things they did was turn a blind eye to the Contras' efforts to sell cocaine to the American people in order to help fund the war. And so that was the... And you know, there's a brand new movie that came out within the last half a year, I think, called American Made with Tom Cruise. It's all about Barry Seal. And... You know, it's no limited hangout. They pretty much tell the story just right, only it's the year 2018. You know, I guess it came out in 2017. But this is the crazy conspiracy theory of the 90s, was that the CIA was allowing the smuggling of massive amounts of cocaine into, well, participating in, not just allowing, into a place called the Nella Airstrip outside of Mena, Arkansas, which, of course, implies, and it's in the movie, the cooperation of Governor Clinton, who in the movie, he calls the U.S. prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, and says, set this guy free, lady. Those orders come from on high. And in the face of 100 cops, he gets to walk right out the door because he gets a call from the governor. And that was the whole thing. And Clinton's associates like Dan Lassiter and all these guys supposedly were involved in the distributing of the coke in Arkansas and throughout the South. And then I know less about the connection to South Florida, but I think that there was a separate chain going to South Florida. And then, you know, it may have been Daniel Hopsicker back then. I don't really like him anymore. He wrote a lot of crap. But back in the 1990s, I think he did a good thing about the drugs that I think touched on the South Florida stuff better. But then most famously was the crack epidemic in Los Angeles and the you know, almost literal war between the Crips and the Bloods over territory, over crack territory in Los Angeles, which became the impetus for the first assault weapons ban and or the excuse for it, right? And huge crackdowns on people for mere possession of drugs. And, you know, this is part of when people ask government to help. First of all, look who's, you know, responsible for bringing the supply in and converting it directly to crack for the poorest people to abuse in the first place. But then secondly, when not just the cocaine itself, but yes, smoking cocaine is pretty damn bad for you. But then, of course, especially the wars over the control of the drug business created such a crisis. And then, but people then turn to the only monopoly government they've got, and they say, you've got to do something. Why don't you care about us? Do something. And so they say, okay, and they pass a new law, and they say, now if you have a couple of rocks in your pocket, you go to prison for 35 years. Or whatever, worse. That's one that sticks in my mind, because I remember somebody sticking a camera up to a gate at a prison, and this young black kid, he's like 19 years old or something, and he goes, I got 35 years for a few rocks in my pocket. Does that sound fair to you? And everybody's like calling out, hey, mom, and whatever, and trying to talk. And he's like, does that seem fair? And that was from back then, you know. He's still sitting in there. Or if he's alive, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was just absolute nightmare. As a part of that. And then so back to Gary Webb then. They successfully destroyed him. He went back to work for, I hope I have that right. I believe he previously had been. And then he went back to work as an investigator for congressional committees because his journalism career was just absolutely dead. They destroyed him. When I interviewed him, it was in, I think, the beginning of 2004, and I was kind of in email communication with him back and forth for a little while, and then he quit answering me, and I would try, like, every little while, because what had happened was when I interviewed him, I'd only read, like, half the book, and then I finally finished the other half of the book, and I wanted to finish up the interview and really give him a chance to say what he had to say, you know? Because at that point, nobody was paying attention to that, really, or very few were giving him any attention or that subject much attention. And then eventually he kind of dropped out of contact, and then by the end of that year, he committed suicide. And this is what brought up the story there, was because it is very suspicious, of, certainly at first glance, and regardless of what everybody thinks about what I think, but the story is he shot himself twice. And no, he was not shot in the back of the head twice. There are people with, you know, rumors go around and get, fail to be verified and stuff. He did shoot himself twice, and the deal is it happens. And the coroner even said, ah, man, you know what? If I'd known that this was such a big deal, who this guy was, and that it was going to be a scandal and all this, I would have explained in the first place that, like, you know what, I'm really sorry to say, but this does happen sometimes, where somebody goes to shoot themselves in the mouth, and they flinch the first time, and then, you know, and they shoot themselves out of the side of the mouth or something like that, and that was what happened in this case, and then he went ahead and followed through. But the story was, and not according to the cops, but according to his people, people like the heroic, the great Robert Perry, the journalist, and Michael Rupert, who he's not so great, but he was still okay, cop versus CIA. He was a former L.A. cop who was – he created cop versus CIA because of all the cocaine dealing there. And they said, no, he committed suicide, dude. He was terribly depressed. He had – you know, someone had – I forgot who had told me this. I don't remember how I knew this, but someone had stolen his motorcycle. He lost his job. Like, that was the last straw. But, like, then they stole his damn motorcycle. He had not even a way to get to work. He had transferred his whole life insurance and all his bank accounts and everything to his wife, or I guess, I don't know his insurance situation, but transferred his bank accounts and everything over to his wife. He left a note. He used a pistol he inherited from his father to do it. And so, you know, that's not to acquit the CIA. It's their fault. I mean, they're the ones who are behind the post. And probably the LA Times, too, and their jihad that they waged against this guy lying about him. They could have done a limited thing where they said, you know what, a couple of our assets did break the law in a couple of cases, and we're really sorry about that. And they could have let it go at that. Instead, they blew this guy up. And so, you know, it was his finger on the trigger on the last day, but they were the ones who put the gun in his hand, figuratively speaking. But not, like, in an excuse way. Like, they are responsible. They killed him. They destroyed the man. So, and what really sucks, man, is that I think if he just held on a little bit longer, he could have just written for Bob Perry at Consortium News. And he could have been a huge part of the good journalism during the George W. Bush and Barack Obama eras and this whole time. That he would have had a place where he could have had a career online. And at that time, right at that time, there was not enough money to actually pay bills being a reporter for something like Consortium News, you know. But if he just held on a little bit longer, he might have been all right, you know. Gareth Porter, you know, has gotten by this whole time writing for Interpress Service and then for Truth Out and for Consortium and places like this. You know what I mean? So I think it's really too bad. Like, right at the end of 2004, well, shit, right at the beginning of 2005 was probably a really good time to get a fresh start on his career, and it might have been okay, you know? But that's the way it is. And you know what? The reason I'm a little bit adamant about the suicide thing, because, you know, a bunch of completely shameless hucksters decided to exploit his death immediately, you know, because when dollars are on the line, it doesn't matter if you're right or wrong or know anything about it or anything. And people just like to make a lot of claims. And again, it does sound suspicious. Somebody shoots themselves twice to death? Like, huh? You know, it's obviously an honest question to raise, but it's not an honest conclusion to leap to without waiting for facts. And then there was somebody who was even making up a story about, oh, yeah, you know, there was some assassin that did it and this and that. And it was just not true. And people like Robert Perry, who was a friend of Gary Webb's and was 100% reliable on something like this, And Michael Rupert, I would say, was 100% reliable on this question, said that, no, absolutely, this was a suicide. And a damn shame, too.
What was he like when you interviewed him?
You know what? Like, almost the only thing I remember about it is I felt so bad because I made a joke. And I said, man, you did all this great work, and all you got for it is you got destroyed over it. And he goes, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I was trying to get a little bit of a punchline kind of thing and was hoping that he would be like, hey, hey, yeah, ain't that always the way or something. But instead it was like, yeah, no, he took it bad, and I felt really sorry about that. I mean, that's just the thing. It's not like it's my fault or whatever, but just that he was already that depressed about it, that he wasn't seeing the humor in the shit, man, you know?
Sometimes you think you can you know, you just you throw the joke out there and you don't know if you don't know how it's going to land. So I mean, shit, sometimes I only open my mouth to switch feet. So
yeah,
you know, it's just
yeah, that was one of those that I sure wish I had not said that at all, or figured out a better way to say it or something. And then, you know, everybody, by the time you're in your 40s, you know somebody who's committed suicide. I've got a few in my past, and I always kind of think about, geez, if only I'd tried harder to be a better friend right around that time or something, you know. Not really taking responsibility for it, but kind of thinking about woulda, coulda, shouldas, you know. And maybe after he didn't laugh, maybe I could have said something like, hey, man, hang in there, dude, you know, like, things have changed sooner than you think or something, you know, I don't know.
Well, but right there when online journalism was really starting to take off and everything, it would have been nice to see what he could have came up with.
Yeah. And especially working with Bob Perry, because Bob Perry is just unapologetically badass on everything. Well, no, he's dead now too. But, you know, he's, you know, obviously a liberal, disagrees with me on a hell of a lot of things, but when it comes down to the facts about every one of these wars and their conflict with Russia and all Ukraine and Syria and everything, I mean, that's the perfect place. And I don't know exactly what the relationship was. I believe they were friends, but that would have been a perfect fit for Gary Webb to just report, just do the truth. He was into it.
Let me ask you, we saw Netanyahu playing his same game again this week.
Yeah.
What is the hard on with Iran for Israel? I mean, obviously they've done business before. They've, you know, done covert shit. What is this obsession with having to, you know, Iran's going to have a nuclear weapon in the next 5 minutes?
Well, so there's a couple of things here. I think first and foremost is the fact that you and I are talking about this and not Palestine right this minute. I think that is the most important thing, is that whenever anybody says Palestine, what about the Gazans who are being slaughtered right now? Instead, Netanyahu says, look, Iran, the threat, Iran, Iran, Iran. And it works, and works like a charm. I think that's the first thing. Now, Scott Ritter has a book called Target Iran that came out in, like, I'm going to call it 2006 or 7 or so. And it says in there, and he was a former weapons inspector, Marine Corps captain, and intelligence officer, and he had done anti-proliferation stuff after the fall of the Soviet Union there, and he had worked as a liaison working with Israeli intelligence for a time in the 1990s as well. And so it's very incredibly and working on Iraq issues. He was the weapons inspector busting Saddam's balls in the 1990s, one of the chiefs there. So he said that they have a doctrine that says that if Iran has a nuclear program, that's tantamount to them having nuclear weapons. And so then that's it. That's what it says on the piece of paper. We have agreed in one meeting or another, it was agreed that this is tantamount to that. So that's it. And so that's the thing. And they'll just always fight against even the existence of an Iranian civilian nuclear infrastructure in any way, because it is all ultimately dual use. It could be. And so you know, they make for a good enemy to demonize. I think that the Reagan era cooperation, you know, really came to an end in the 1990s. Gareth Porter, in his book Manufactured Crisis, says that it was actually Yitzhak Rabin who was trying to give up the West Bank and Gaza Strip to be a separate, independent Palestinian state, who was later assassinated by a Netanyahu fan, by the way, which scotched that deal. And he, Yitzhak Rabin, while he was in the middle of these negotiations on the so-called Land for Peace under Oslo, he said, "Look, everybody, Iran," in order to distract the hawks so that he could get away with quote-unquote murder, doing the right thing here for the Palestinians and letting them go. And but so once he was out of the way, I forget who was next. I think there was a caretaker prime minister for just a minute before Netanyahu came in 96. I forget. But certainly beginning with Netanyahu when he came in the first time in 96, and then Ehud Barak and Ariel Sharon and Ehud Olmert, and now Netanyahu again, have all said, "Iran, Iran, Iran," to distract from the fact that they will never give up Palestine, that they will never let the people of Gaza and the West Bank and et cetera be free. And so whenever anybody brings it up, they have this as their great distraction. So, you know, it's just embedded right in there. And, of course, it's good for business when your business is weapons sales. And so, you know, they know how to stay on the good side of the war party in America, too, which is constantly hawking it up no matter what. It's good for airplane sales, and airplane sales are the single most important thing in our society, man. It comes down to it, apparently, according to the judgment of our Congress.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they've been slaughtering Palestinians now for a couple weeks, and then all of a sudden they just – you know, he comes out with a PowerPoint presentation, and
he's trying to undermine the nuclear deal because Trump is about to decide whether he's going to take America out of the JCPOA or not. And so this is supposed to give him an excuse. And by the way, the presentation he gave was all just a bunch of hype. On the surface, he's bringing up a bunch of old stuff. But according to Gareth Porter, and I don't think his new article has come out yet, but we're going to have to talk to him about it, that no, this is all still the same old quote-unquote alleged studies and possible military dimensions, which is a slightly larger category of accusations, that he's already debunked in Manufactured Crisis, that, you know, including the part where the nuclear bomb is supposed to fit in the warhead in the nose cone of the missile, that was even debunked by, I think, the Israeli asset. I don't know that, but it seems like it. David Albright from ISIS, the Institute for Making Up Lies About Iran's Nuclear Program, basically most of the time. But he wrote a letter to the editor years ago slamming David Sanger, spit, and his partner William J. Broad at the New York Times when they ran with this story. And even Sanger debunked this and said that, you know, this isn't true. And in fact, you know, Gareth shows how, in his work, how it's based on their old nose cone. But by the time that they had come out with the fake intelligence that this was the warhead that the Iranians were building, the Iranians had already debuted their new generation rocket that had a totally different nose cone. It went from a triangular one to a dolphin nose, baby bottle shaped one that wouldn't fit that warhead at all. And that would have to be an entirely separate design. So why would they be working on a bomb to fit in their old nose cone when all their new missiles have the new nose cone and this and that? And the whole thing was just hype. This is all old lies. It's not just old, but it ain't true in the first place. And, you know, we'll see the full scale of that when Gareth's report comes out. But these possible military dimensions, at the very worst, go with, you know, the Jeffrey Lewis arms control wonk view of it, is that these are, and for that matter, the CIA and all the European countries, governments, and everybody else, and the IAEA, their view of it is the IAEA has already investigated all of this stuff. None of this is new to them. And none of it says that Iran is in violation of the agreement right now in any way. The worst that Netanyahu could the worst smoke that he could blow out of that whole presentation was that, see, they didn't completely fess up to everything they ever did wrong before the agreement ever took place. But, of course, all of this research is all just paperwork and whatever. Even if you take it at face value, they are not obligated to tell the IAEA if they do a study into the feasibility of fission. They're required to notify the IAEA within 6 months before they introduce nuclear material into machinery to use, to do something with. That was the deal. Now, the deal's expanded now. That was the previous deal. So, in other words, they weren't in violation of the NPT. They weren't in violations of their safeguards agreement. And if what he's accusing them of doing in the past was true, if they were doing it now, it would be in violation of the agreement. Even if it was true they did it in the past, it absolutely in no way amounts to a violation of the agreement. So all this is basically just a bunch of nonsense to try to make it look like, for people who aren't paying attention very close, that there's something new here. And, you know, built in with this story that I don't believe, although who knows, I guess, that, yeah, Israeli heroic spies snuck into Iran in the middle of the night and emptied this warehouse of all this intelligence and got away with it. And doesn't that sound like an episode of a TV show or something to make it, you know, help the medicine go down or whatever, I guess, to make the story exciting and more believable that way. But sounds like it's the same old smoking laptop that's been debunked by the likes of Gareth Porter and Scott Ritter and others for more than a decade now, since 2005.
And basically, all the inspectors and everybody who's sober on this subject believes that Iran is not violating the agreement at all. Right.
And even Netanyahu's accusations don't really say that they're violating the agreement. He's just saying they lied before the agreement. And in fact, you know what, you want to take the temperature of the hawks on this, Josh Rogan, who, he ain't the worst of them, because he does know how to read and stuff, and he is, you know, he's not a liar, although I certainly disagree with him on a lot of things. He's a very neoconservative reporter for the Washington Post, but I saw him on CNN right after Netanyahu's presentation, and he was being very fair, and he was saying, listen, if you take everything he says at face value, one could argue, a hawk could argue, that this is a good reason to stay in the deal. You know, I mean, what deal are we talking about? Are we talking about the deal? Or are we talking about the deal of Donald Trump's rhetorical flourish that is actually an entirely different thing, and it's not even actually a thing at all, right? The deal, there was this deal where we gave them money, and it was the worst deal in the world, and they got all this money. He went on this whole tangent the other day. Cash, can you believe it? Cash, a pile of cash. It was cash piled on top of other cash, a stack of it, and blah, blah, blah. And completely ignoring, well, what's Iran's side of the deal? Iran's side of the deal is they broke their spine bending over backwards to accommodate Israel and the USA. They gave up virtually everything other than their bare bones enrichment capability. You know, their plan to build light water reactors, but they poured concrete into their core of their heavy water reactor. They turned off 2/3 of the centrifuges at Natanz, and they completely shut down all production of uranium at COM and turned it only into a research facility and what have you. They also signed the additional protocol and additional subsidiary arrangements to their safeguards agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, which make them the most inspected country in the world in all history forever times 10, because they already were. They already were the most inspected country by the IAEA ever. And now they just quite deliberately signed a thing saying that the IAEA now can have surprise inspections at any nuclear facility anywhere that they can, and of course they still have their sensors and monitors and cameras up 24 hours a day anyway, but now they can go to the centrifuge factories where they make the things where there's no nuclear material at all, but they can count whatever resources are there and this kind of thing. They can monitor the mines themselves, and if they have any reason to believe, any actual evidence, because you will hear this as an argument, man. Oh, yeah, well, what about all their military bases? We can't just walk right in the front gate of every military base in Iran on a moment's notice. So, therefore, they could be hiding something. That's an argument. I hear it quite often, actually. And so the answer to that is, if the Americans have any evidence at all, you know who they have to convince that they have evidence? Not the Iranians. They have to convince the Germans, the French, and the British, our closest allies in the world, that the evidence that they have is something. And that's enough votes on the committee, excluding Russia and China. Even if Russia and China say, no, we agree with Iran, doesn't matter. If America can get our closest allies to agree with us that we think this evidence is a thing, then they have to let us in. And if they won't, then all of the sanctions immediately, quote, snap back. They don't need to be re-implemented. They're there just waiting for the key to be turned. And so the Iranians have given up really even the potential to make nuclear weapons. And, of course, they've been a member of the NPT and sworn to not make nuclear weapons this whole time. Whatever Netanyahu accused them of doing is not in violation of the NPT, because they never did have, even if you take, again, at face value, everything that he claimed was true there, all that shows is they had a research program into what it would be like if they made one, dude, not a bomb program. They never had a bomb program. You know, he showed some picture of a hemisphere of metal. Well, if that's uranium at all, it's depleted uranium. It is not weapons-grade uranium. They never made that. They never have bomb fuel. That never existed. A nice little slideshow.
What do you think happens if Trump backs out of the deal?
Man, I really don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that cooler heads will prevail in Europe and in Iran. But the problem is, if the Americans back out of the deal, then that means all the sanctions are back on. And America is the global hegemon, economically speaking. And so, you know, first of all, these are our allied states who are trying to do business, our closest allies in NATO and everything in Europe, who are trying to do business with Iran now. But if it comes down to it where anybody who does business with them can't do business with us, well, that'll stop overnight. So I don't know, and I'm really not the expert on the sanctions. I really ought to get Tyler Cullis on the show to talk all about this, but I think he's the expert from the National Iranian American Council. Tell him I sent you. So I don't know exactly how severe the sanctions would affect the European companies and governments' decisions on this, but I'm afraid that the answer is severely. And that, in fact, the Americans have really refused to live up to their side of the deal all along, because they've left some sanctions in place that they promised to lift. And also they keep this permanent regime uncertainty, the term that Robert Higgs coined about FDR during the Great Depression. He changed the rules so often anybody with money would just sit on it. Well, that's the same kind of thing here, where the Americans are constantly threatening to revisit their agreement to this agreement. And so that basically, if you're an international shipping firm with billions of dollars in credit and what have you, this and that on the line, you don't mess with the U.S. Treasury. You don't do anything. So it becomes a de facto blockade, if you know, just because of people's fears about what may happen in the future. And so the American side of the deal, that if you give into this, we will more, you know, almost completely normalize economic relations with your country. They have not lived up to that at all. Donald Trump wants to cry boo-hoo about cash money. That was their money. That wasn't American welfare money. That was their money that Jimmy Carter stole after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. All America did was give it back to them. And in fact, I love this part of it. There was it wasn't the World Court, it was some other, the Court of International World Settlements or something. It wasn't the Bank for International Settlements. It was some court decision, that international court decision, that ruled that the Americans have to give them their money back now. And so all the Americans agreed to do under Obama in this deal was not just give them their own money back, but give them their own money back that they were going to have to give back anyway. And they weren't going to buck the international court on this, it wasn't worth it or whatever. So they were going to end up giving them the money back anyway. So they basically said, yeah, that money that we're going to give you, we'll go ahead and give it to you as a condition of your condition. So, you know, and it's funny, you know, from time to time people say, Wayne, why do you love the Ayatollah so much or whatever? But that's not it. I mean, I'm a Texan. I don't care about the Ayatollah. What the hell do I care about him? It's just that everything you say about him is a lie. So I have to kind of confront that when people are trying to get us into a war, especially for the interests of foreign powers like Saudi Arabia and especially Israel. over something that is no threat. And, you know, here's the bottom line, too, because you might ask me, Scott, how come America backs al-Qaeda in Syria? And it doesn't make sense to me. And I would say to you, because even though the al-Qaeda guys are the enemies of the American people because of our government, of course, but even, you know, they've killed American civilians, and you know, they were a huge part of the – or a deadly part, I should say, an important part of the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq War II that killed 4,000 of out of 4,500 of the Americans that died there. And yet the American government's major enemy is not them. It's Iran. Because Iran is independent from America, and now especially because of Iraq War II, which benefited the Shiite supermajority and parties, specific parties, that were backed by the Iranians all along. Now that their power has been so greatly enhanced in the region because of George W. Bush's war there, now the Americans and the Saudis and the Israelis are going crazy because they scored such a huge own goal for their regional nemesis that now they're resorting to all these crazy things like back in al-Qaeda and eventually leading to the rise of the Islamic State there for a few years in order to try to limit their power, which of course has only backfired and improved the position of Iran in Iraq after Iraq War III, and of course especially in Syria, where now their special forces guys are there working with Hezbollah and working with the Russians and the Syrian government to finish killing off the last of the CIA-backed jihadis in Idlib province, for example. And so now the Americans are screaming bloody murder even more, that, oh, my God. And Donald Trump, who's like basically just a minor bird for these guys, he was on TV just last week saying, oh, Iran, Iran, Iran. Yeah, Iran is bad. Iran does all these things. Iran is the enemy. They're the major problem. Everybody knows that. They're the world sponsor of terrorism. They're the real thing. You know what? In Iraq, they're the problem. In Syria, they're the problem. In Yemen, they're the problem. Everywhere I look, it's Iran. And all he really means to say is, that's what my staff told me this morning, and I'm too stupid to say, yeah, but because of you and you and you, and particularly General Mattis, who led the Marines into Iraq from Kuwait to kill Saddam for the Ayatollah. Before you come crying to me about Iran, how about, well, I shouldn't finish that sentence the way I was going to. How about you don't come crying to me about Iran, since you're the guy who is the Ayatollah's humble and loyal servant, Mr. Secretary of Defense.
Hmm. All right, Scott, I'm going to wrap it up there. Plug away, man.
Well, all my websites are broken, man, but my sites are on YouTube. Shit. YouTube.com/Scott Horton Show. I have my interviews there, and but usually it's libertarianinstitute.org and scotthorton.org. Those will work again someday, maybe. And then, yeah, I'm the opinion editor at antiwar.com. And I wrote a book, and the audiobook's out now, too, if you like audiobooks. It's Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. And it's on Amazon and all those places. And everybody likes it, so.
It's a friggin' amazing book, and the audiobook is awesome, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, you did a superb job with that. It's one of the best audiobooks I've listened to a lot, and it's one of the best I've ever listened to.
Wow.
You did really well with it.
Cool. Thank you very much for that.
All right, man. So, once again, thanks for coming on, and until the next time.
Very happy to do it. Appreciate it, man.
Well, that's it. I want to remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right, on Amazon. Check it out. I should be back on the weekend with another podcast. So, until then, take care. Have a great week. Bye.